I'm Michael Rosenbaum, Lex Luthor, and always hold on to Smallville.
Welcome to Always Hold On to Smallville. On this podcast, we talk about each and every episode of the Young Superman show that ran from 2001 to 2011 on the WB and the CW. I'm your host, Zach Moore, and this time I'm joined by writer for Sci-Fi Fangirls, Miss Trisha Ennis. What's up, Trisha?
Yo, how's it going?
It's great. It's great. Now, this is your first appearance on the podcast. You will be back to talk about an actual episode of Smallville. But this is a Superman special this week because recently Warner Brothers Archive has released the Blu-ray of Supergirl, the movie, the first big-budget film, superhero film starring a woman, which people made a big deal out of Wonder Woman last year, and it was great. Wonder Woman, by far the best of these, because you have Supergirl, you have Catwoman, and you have Elektra. And these were all failures for various reasons, none of which had to do with it being a woman in the lead. But I think somewhere along the way, someone in Hollywood made that connection, and we just haven't had even the great Marvel Cinematic Universe has yet to give us. We're still waiting on that Black Widow movie, right? So, but DC does a lot wrong, but it does super women right now because of Wonder Woman. What we're talking about today is how they did Supergirl back in the 80s. I don't know about that so much, but before we jump into it, Trisha, kind of talk about your Superman fandom, how you kind of fell into the character and became a fan of the whole Superman world.
Sure. So when I was a kid in the 90s, that was the Lois and Clark, the New Adventures of Superman era. So I watched that when I was little and loved it. I don't remember watching like every episode because when you're a kid, you don't like sit down and watch every single episode of everything, but I definitely watched it all the time with my parents and it was really fun and I wanted to be Lois and, I had a crush on Jimmy.
which Jimmy did you have a crush on? Do you remember the
second one?
Okay.
Specifically the second one. Yeah. So then that went off the air and I mean, that show was cheesy, but it was perfect when you're like, you know, six or seven. And you don't really care that it's cheesy, or that Brainiac is literally a guy with a giant head. And then when, like, I sort of fell off comic books for a really long time and Superman stuff, and I've seen all the Superman movies up to that point. Like, in 2006, I saw Superman Returns, but I wasn't, like, a big Superman fan until college. And that's when I decided to sit down and actually watch all 10 seasons of Smallville, because Smallville had just recently ended. And I watched all 10 seasons in, like, a month, and then That was it. That was when I started reading comics and watching everything. And I've since watched Smallville like four or five times and all the various superhero films, and including Supergirl, which the reason that we make such a big deal about Wonder Woman is because this movie sucks.
this movie is mental. Like, I don't know what they were doing. They had the Superman franchise was going on at the time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was right after Superman 3
movies. Yeah, so yeah. That's its own discussion on how the devolution of the Superman franchise, right? But the original Superman the movie, it to me is still like the gold standard for Superman movies and superhero movies. You know, even the great Chris Nolan compares, you know, his Batman Begins to Superman the movie. So to have a franchise with that kind of pedigree turn into what it turned into is a tragedy of its own. But then, you know, this was, Supergirl was supposed to be a real spinoff of those movies because it's the same, the Salkinds, Alexander and Elias Salkind were the producers. Like, they were shepherding the whole Superman mythos and at the time in the 80s. And this was going to be a spinoff. And Christopher Reeve was actually going to be in this film in a limited capacity. But he dropped out at the last minute, which really hurt the film. And I have my suspicions that based off how Superman 3 turned out, he was like, okay, I'm out. And then that really left a big Superman-shaped hole in this movie. I think that's a huge
problem.
And yet
he still made Superman 4.
Yes. He came back years later to do 4.
That movie still exists.
Yes. And, you know, Superman 3 gets a bad rap, but, you know, when you're like, oh, man, this is not like the comic books, if you're going to it with that attitude, you're not going to like it, right?
Right.
But actually, if you take a step back, I think Christopher Reeve is probably his best performance of Superman and Clark because he has a lot to do as Clark. He has a lot to do with Superman. He gets evil Superman. That's a really great little subplot in the mess of a film. I love the love story between Lana and Clark in that film with Annette O'Toole, Martha Kent from Smallville. And then, Richard Pryor's kind of funny. It's completely out of place and shouldn't be in a Superman movie. But it's a heck of a lot better than Superman 4, and it's a heck of a lot better than Supergirl. Because because Christopher Reeve backed out, Superman doesn't appear in this film. Superman appears as a poster.
Yes. It's a now, poster. Being a heck of a lot better than Supergirl is not a high bar, admittedly. Because this movie is nuts. Like, absolutely insane and also bad, which is unfortunate. Especially because she was the first female superhero movie.
And then, I think it really was Catwoman 20 years later, in 2004, which was the next female-led superhero film. And we say superhero, it's Catwoman. She's a supporting Batman character. So
yeah, and that's also if you only consider like traditional superheroes to be superheroes, because they also made a Red Sonja movie around the same time as Supergirl, which was also terrible. But, they tried.
But what is it, though, you think? What is the code they couldn't crack with female-led superhero films, or even just fantasy comic book films starring women?
I feel like we'll get into this, but if you're watching Supergirl, they approach her so totally differently from her cousin when they don't have to. Like, I think one of the reasons that Supergirl, the current one on the CW, works so well is because they just treat her as Superman, but, like, she wears a skirt. And this movie does not. Like, even the way she flies is totally different from the way Superman flies. It's all, like, wafty and girl-like. And, they treat her as a kid, and they don't, like, her Linda Lee plot is stupid compared to, everything else. And the whole plot of this film isn't so much, until, like, the last 15, 20 minutes, isn't so much her stopping, like, Superman gets Lex Luthor's ridiculous and deadly real estate plan, and then also I'm gonna turn back time in the first Superman movie, and Supergirl gets a witch who's trying to, make a boy fall in love with her.
Yes, the classic, it's a girl, so her main villain must be a woman as well, which I really applauded Wonder Woman for not doing that in her films. Like, it's Hades, a male villain. It's insane. Do you think a woman could stand up against a man? This is mind-boggling thoughts that we're having here in comic book.
Yeah, having Wonder Woman fight, like, the idea of war was an interesting and really good choice. And they treated Wonder Woman maturely and interestingly and with an amount of respect that I just don't think they had for Supergirl. Uh-huh. They went full camp for this.
Uh-huh. It does feel more like 60s Batman than Superman movie, right?
It does. But even 60s Batman was almost, like, nicer to its women than this movie.
Well, in this movie, it's weird because you look at the way it was put together, right? Mm-hmm. And I'll say this: I never watched Supergirl start to finish until I bought this Blu-ray that came out from Warner Archive, and start to finish, because I'd seen it, like, bits and pieces on TV over the years, because it used to show a lot on TV. I actually bought a Laserdisc of it a few years ago, because I'm a Laserdisc collector, because I'm weird that like that. But I never watched it. I was waiting for, like, a special occasion. Well, here it is. There's my special occasion. This is the first time I sat down and watched it properly. And now, of course, podcasting about it, like, giving some commentary and analysis on it. I did some research, of course, as well, to trivia and whatnot, and I was surprised to learn there are, like, five different versions of this movie, and I don't know if they were, like, trying to save it or something, and then editing. Today we have director's cut this and Blu-ray cut that. I mean, we have an international version, we have a director's cut, we have a U.S. theatrical version, we have, like, a home video cut, and then we have another version as well. And it's like, look, guys, so the Blu-ray is the international cut, and that's the one I watched. And that's supposed to be the best, I think, or I don't know.
I believe, and I'm not 100% positive, but I believe any DVD version of Supergirl is the international cut. Because it's, like, it's a bunch of minutes longer. I can't remember exactly how many. Because the original studio cut it down to 96 minutes. Which is a lot shorter than the version that I watched, which was over 2 hours. And I don't know how you could cut stuff out, because, like, very quickly I'm like, we're missing plot.
Even, I don't know. Even the international version, I'm like, are we sure this is the, like, most complete version. No, well, the director's cut was included in this Blu-ray set,
okay,
but they don't have the HD elements for the director's cut, apparently. So that's why it will only exist in perpetuity as a DVD, as a standard definition. I have not watched that one, because honestly, I considered watching both versions, but one was enough in one dose for me. So I watched the International Cut Blu-ray, which actually looks, they restored the picture. It looks great, much like Warner Archive did with Superman the movie, the extended TV cut. So good on them there. I like that we're getting these, you know, as time goes on, we're running out of Superman stuff to release, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm glad there's still these, like, lost to history, maybe for better or for worse, lost to history, but I'm glad they're still out there to discover as we go on. So the director's cut is a little longer. The director's cut is 2 hours and 18 minutes, and the international cut is 2 hours and 4 minutes, and the U.S. theatrical cut is 1 hour and 45 minutes, which is insane. They cut 20 minutes from this film that I just watched. It's already kind of incomprehensible. Like, as you said, you can already identify things that are missing. I can't imagine going to a theater in the 80s and watching this and being like, what is this? And then there's lots of other little cuts, like a TV cut and a UK cut and all this stuff, right? But anyway, there's lots of... When you sit down and you talk about Supergirl, a lot of people have seen different versions, and I think that's interesting. Like, where like people are talking about different films.
Yeah, exactly. The missing plot and stuff, there's a lot of, like, assumptions that they make about your knowledge. Like, they assume you've seen Superman, so you know all her powers.
Oh, that's true. There is no, like, Krypton, like, you know, you think about the Superman movie, there's so much scope, right? You go to Krypton, and you establish the planet, and it blows up. This one, actually, I must give it credit. The opening credits were pretty cool. I thought, you know what, this looks slick. This could be in a movie today. I'm like, they obviously splurged their budget on the opening credits, right? So you get this great opening credits, and then you, like, cut to, I couldn't tell what it was.
It's
I was
Argo, like, City.
Yeah, but it's like this glowing light in complete blackness. I'm like, what am I looking at?
But it's like their weird-ass version of Argo City, which is like a giant crystal floating through space.
Yeah, because they're in inner space, and Superman is in outer space, right? But they know about Krypton. They know what exploded. They know about Earth, and they know that Kal-El went to Earth and is Superman. It's so, because Peter O'Toole, who is the Marlon Brando of this movie, was that their approach?
I guess.
In his Christmas sweater.
I referred to it by something that I will not say on this podcast. God, his sweaters were awful. And they were like toga sweaters. They went down to his knees. But he was something in this movie. He had, his line delivery was very interesting. And he was just very interesting. He had a thing for, like, weird objects. Like, his very special wand at the beginning. And, like, who let him on Argo City? Like, he just steals the Omegahedron to play with. And it's, like, the thing that's powering the whole city.
Yeah, that's very risky and kind
of...
Oh, God. well, and he's a character named Zoltar.
Yes.
Who is Zoltar? I know comic books. I've never heard of this guy before. Why is he not? Because when I was like watching this on TV every now and then when I was a kid, I was like, oh, I get it. He is Zor-El, her dad, much like Marlon Brando was Jor-El, Superman's dad. That's cool. They cop go to blah, blah, blah. And I kind of filled in those gaps in my head. But then, like, the more I would see of it, and then I, like, you know, did a little research online and finally watching the movie, he's just some, like, mentor, goofy guy who founded Argo City. And they never explain why it's in inner space or why it's, or how it's related to Krypton exactly. We do get Zor-El and Allura for like five minutes. Allura played by Mia Farrow for some reason.
Like, Mia Farrow is in this movie, and I don't know how they got Mia Farrow to play that part.
This is in the 80s. She's like it legit Hollywood actress at this time.
Right.
So strange.
She's
choice.
The Marlon Brando.
yes.
Like, how the hell did you get Marlon Brando to be in Superman? And then how the hell did you get Mia Farrow to be, like, totally fine with being in Supergirl? I don't know. As this character who gets, like, three lines, and one of them is just yelling.
Yeah, and then you never go back, right? Because the beginning, not to jump ahead, but, like, you have this establishing crisis on Argo City, the Megahedron flight, because Kara's messing around with it, and Zoltar's trying to hide it, that he stole it. And then she makes a dragonfly, and it rips the tent, and it flies into space or whatever. So I did like, by the way, that you saw, like, the Superman blankets in this pod that Kara goes in. You're like, oh, that must be where the suit came from. So I give him some credit for that. But anyway, you think there's going to be, like, a bookend where she, because at the end of the movie, she's like, all right, I'm going to go back and save my city. And she flies off, and then, like, she's flying towards the Argo City model, and then it's like, directed by Janelle Swark. It's like, oh, it's over now. Okay. Yep. Like, I thought there was going to be a bookend, and I'm like, is there a deleted scene? No. Maybe they ran out of budget, but they never go back to this. So all this Argo City stuff, like I said, Mia Farrow, they're 5 minutes of these people, gone. And then and it looks like a weird, like, Logan's Run Mall of the Future, really, more than a... Because give Superman the movie looked alien. I know they had a much bigger budget. I get that, but I don't know what they could have done on their budget, so I don't want to harp on them too hard, but it didn't... I was not sold this was an alien planet.
that's the thing. And, like, but the whole thing with Argo City is that it confuses the crap out of people who don't know what Argo City is. Like, if you have no idea that it's a piece of Krypton floating out in space and not Krypton itself, then you're just like, wait, I thought Krypton exploded. Like, why are we back there? What's happening?
But they're in inner space.
They're in inner... Well, that they don't tell you that until after, like, he's like, we have to leave inner space and go to outer space. And also, that pod, I swear to God, I thought it was a table and chairs.
Yeah, it's just a little coffee table.
I was like, why is
she
sitting on a table? And then it closes around her, and I'm like, oh, it's a pod.
Oh,
just sort of sitting out in the open.
Oh.
Yeah, Argo City is special. But, I mean, that stuff's definitely weird, and it does feel like you missed stuff, because... If I didn't know what Argo City was, I have friends who have watched this movie and been like, why the hell are they back on Krypton? But it doesn't get super weird until you meet the villain in, like, the next scene.
Yes. There's no Superman, and this is something I wanted to mention off the top here. Like, it takes the same, it thinks it's taking the same skeleton as Superman the movie, because, like, all right, here we go. We cast an unknown actress. We surround her with Hollywood famous people like Peter O'Toole and Faye Dunaway, right? And then we just kind of fill stuff out. We have a little origin at the beginning, right? And then we just, and we go into her superhero dome. Well, here's the main problem. First of all, it was not executed well at all compared to what they have. So this is like Superman the movie in the wrong hands is what Supergirl the movie is. Sorry to say it, but these are the facts. Okay. Proof is in the pudding. But they skip over such a crucial part of Superman the movie was, like, the Smallville section, right? The transition between you have Alien, you have Norman Rockwell America, and then you have, like big city superhero comic book strip brought to life, right? Those are the three acts of Superman the movie. This one just skips over all that, and we go from weird Argo City, which you still don't quite understand or even feel sympathy for the other. These people seem like jerks anyway. Like, I don't care if they're losing their power source. They're all idiots screwing around with their, like you said, their power source being so rambunctious. I don't know. There's a word for that I can't think of right now. But so we immediately go from Kara gets in this pod, goes off, and then we see Faye Dunaway as Selina talking to her witch warlock boyfriend, Nigel?
Something. I was too distracted by the entire tiger they were sitting on.
Yes, because she's evil, you see. She's killed a tiger.
It's his freaking tiger. He carries it away at the end. Like, how is your picnic blanket an entire tiger skin rug complete with head? Upon which she places some kind of sauce.
What is it with the Superman movies and these dead animals? Remember the pink bear in Superman 2? What is that?
Oh, God. I've walked that out.
The Omega Hedron. Right, it's this orb, and it's flying through space, and it looks a lot like my blue snowball microphone here.
It does.
it falls into her pudding or whatever, and then that's the orb. It's like Venom in Spider-Man 3. It just falls out of the sky and to the right place at the right time. There it is.
And then she picks it up, and it, like, immediately tells her what it is and what it does.
Yeah, there's some weird interaction between these people's, like, dark magic and the Kryptonian technology, I will say this, good on them for doing something different, I guess, for weakening superheroes, because there's no kryptonite, right? Because kryptonite is a weakness for Superman, but also magic is, and no one ever talks about that. But movies like this are why no one ever talks about that, because it's very hard to do.
But they didn't even really lean into the idea of magic being a thing that Kryptonians are, like, susceptible to. She was just a witch. So... Mm. Like, Kara didn't have any kind of special weakness to Selina's powers. She
I guess
just
it was universal
was
weakness. Yeah, I see what you mean. Yeah.
Yeah, so it was like, it wasn't like kryptonite for Superman, and how, like, in Superman 1, he gets the kryptonite necklace thing that Ms. Hessmacher pulls off of him, and that's, you know, the big climax is, oh my God, will Superman be able to, you know, get to the thing? And this is... I mean, she ends up in the Phantom Zone, which is at least something, but it's so weird the way that they treat this movie. And, like, they could have done something cool with the fact that she's weak to magic, but would have had to establish a lot more than they did.
Which they're not interested in establishing a damn thing
Yeah, movie. And this whole movie felt like it was all about weird magic. Like, even all the Kryptonian science felt like, no, we just magic.
Well, you know, technology sufficiently advanced is indistinguishable from magic.
I have heard that before. You know, someone said that a long time ago.
Well, yeah, and that's, they do treat, you know, there are some weird transitions in the Christopher Reeve films from Clark Kent to Superman where he's like running down an alley. And that's like an iconic moment of Superman 2. But you think about it, like, what's going on here? Like, is, like, I don't see him, like, he's just morphing into Superman. Or even, like, he jumps out a window and he does a little spin and then he's Superman. Like, what is this, like, the Wonder Woman? Like which he spins around. And Kara in this movie, like, goes behind trees and does all these weird shape-shifting things with her clothes. Like, she just looks at these schoolgirls' clothes and assimilates them. And there's some weird transitions here between Supergirl and Kara.
Apparently, Supergirl can just morph into other things. My favorite clothing transition is when you get the split screen of her inside the dorm room and the outside the dorm room, and she flies through the window and is just in Supergirl's costume. Oh, also the fact that she appears from inner space into the Earth and is just in a Supergirl costume.
Yeah, no explanation. She just flies out of a lake, by the way, completely dry.
Yeah, like the friggin' Lady of the Lake in King Arthur.
Exactly, I thought that as well. Now, let's talk about Helen Slater as Supergirl.
Okay.
Helen Slater, all right, goes on to play Lara, mm-hmm. Clark Kent's or Kal-El's biological mother in Smallville for a few episodes. Good stunt casting, didn't really fit the role very much. In my opinion. And now you fast forward to Supergirl 2015, right? That's when the show came out. The CW Supergirl show, right?
Yeah.
She plays Eliza Danvers.
Yes.
Her adoptive mother. Great in this role. This really fits Helen Slater's wheelhouse as an actress, I guess, more so than playing Lara on Smallville did. And again, I love seeing her in Smallville, don't get me wrong, but I felt like it was just stunt casting for the sake of it, and I really feel like she's like a full three-dimensional character on Supergirl. So she's a good actress and still beautiful. Hasn't aged much at all in the last 30 years, so good on her.
Yeah, she was surprisingly good in this movie because she was like 17 or something when they cast her.
Yeah, she was, I think, maybe 18. Like, she was fresh out of the high school to doing this film.
Yeah, she was young. She looks young.
Yeah.
They cast very young, as opposed to, well, I guess Christopher Reeve was 26 in Superman.
He just looked, Christopher Reeve looked like a leading man. Like, he looked like 35 years old almost his whole life, so.
Yeah, and also I love that performance. But, but she was surprisingly good. Like, I thought Supergirl was going to be less fun. Like, weirdly, like, I think my least favorite performance was Peter O'Toole. Mr. Lawrence of Arabia himself. But Faye Dunaway was definitely the best, I think.
Oh, yeah. Faye Dunaway, I don't know if she does or doesn't know what movie she's in. But she's doing a great job. She turns up to 11 regardless. Like, she's having a ball, and that's at least entertaining to watch, right?
The only person who knows what movie they're in is the woman who played Bianca, who was just perpetually drunk the whole time.
Who gets sucked away to hell or whatever at the end just for being by proxy, right? For being
someone has Selena's to. Friend.
Now, Selena, by the way, made up for this film. Again, they were doing this in the Superman movies. I don't understand, right? In the first movie, got Lex Luthor, great. Second movie, got the three villain script on Zod, not under Superman 3, it's like, here's Gus Gorman and a supercomputer. I'm like, okay. And then you get Nuclear Man. It's like, okay, can we get some comic book villains, please? And then we get Selena in this movie. It's like, really? But it's interesting, all these years later, in the nostalgia, right, because we're all about nostalgia now at comic books, they brought Selena into the comic books in 2017 in the Supergirl comic books for the first time.
Read them yet. They did?
I haven't read that either.
That's
I was shocked.
That's amazing.
So I'm going to go seek that out and find it. And they're bringing Nuclear Man into the Superman comic books as well.
I knew that.
Because we cannot, because, you know, it's the 20-teens and everyone loves the 80s these days, basically what it comes down to. So nostalgia rules.
No one should love the 80s. The 80s were a weird decade.
So, great casting, I guess, in theory, right? Faye Dunaway, a legendary Hollywood actress.
Oh, yeah, and, like, she definitely, she chews all the scenery. Mm-hmm. She's great as Selena. I think if you're going to get someone, you know, she has all the most ridiculous lines. She has a great one toward the end when Kara approaches her and she's like, you act like everyone should bow to you or something like that. And she's like, well, they should.
No, I had that in my notes somewhere. I thought that was, like, the best line of the movie. What is it here? stand by, because I thought this was just so hilarious. Okay. Oh, yeah. She's like, you act like everyone was put on this earth to serve you. And she's like, well, more or less, I think they were.
Yes, exactly.
Like, that is a brilliant fill-in line. I love that.
I love it so much. But, so, Selena, you know, we get to this character who literally her opening, like, thing, talking to her weird boyfriend, Nigel, is that she literally wants to rule the world. That's, like, her goal. Mm-hmm. She wants to rule the world. And then she gets dropped with this Omegahedron, doesn't know what it is, but then immediately knows what it is and what to do with it, and then basically just uses it to turn on various things.
Yeah, like the car. He's like, you can't leave me, so you don't have the car keys. And the car takes off. By the way, when she gets in the car and drives off, there's a radio announcement that Superman has embarked on a peacekeeping mission to a distant galaxy. And I was like, really, guys? This is how you're going to tell us that Superman's not in the movie? It's like, if you're not paying attention, you would have totally missed that. But that's their excuse. That's why Superman's not here. I think I choose to see that he went to go look for Krypton. You know, this takes place after Superman 2, before Superman Returns. That's how I choose to see it.
There you go. Okay, you use your own little headcanon. So like, she just uses it to turn on various like heavy machinery. Like, she turns on the car. She turns on and drives the big backhoe thing that she uses to try to kill people. And then an amusement park ride. And it's like this thing, according to our friend Zoltar, can create the, quote, illusion of life. And you're using it to drive stuff.
And then she makes, like, echo versions of herself.
Yeah, that was confusing.
And you know what? And doesn't even use it for the main crux of the plot, which is trying to get this guy to fall in love with her.
Right.
It has nothing to do with that.
I don't know if the thing was supposed to have enhanced her magic ability or if it was just sort of there being ominous. And she puts it in this weird, like, satanic goat skull box thing. Mm-hmm. And initially it's inside the head of the thing. And then I swear it grows. Because by the end of the movie, it's like an entire bust of something.
Well, I was wondering why they kept doing this, and I realized it, because for some reason, I don't know where this came from, but Supergirl has this wristwatch.
Yes.
Looks like a Fitbit, and it blinks every time that she's in proximity of the Omegahedron, but then when Selena puts it inside the rhino devil head thing, then they mention that it's made out of lead, right?
Okay.
That must block the Kryptonian signals. They're mixing all these Superman rules, again, that they don't establish at all, because we know that lead will, you know, shield Kryptonians or Kryptonite, right, and vice versa. I figured out I assume that's what they were trying to say with that. Like, oh, look, that's why she can't find it, because it's inside this case. And why she even put it in there to begin with, because she couldn't control it. I mean, what do you think? Should they have made her, like, a very competent witch, and this just enhanced her power, or did you like that she was incompetent? I felt like that was a pullover from the Christopher Reeve movies, where, like, Otis and Miss Tismach were, like, these bumbling villains, and people liked that, I guess, in the 70s and 80s, so they kept that going with these guys.
They don't like them as the villains. Like, they're not the bad guys. Lex Luthor is the bad guy, and yeah, Lex Luthor's plan is ridiculous, but it...
That is one of the best plans in superhero movies. It's genius.
It's at least simple in terms of, like, what he's trying... He's not trying to take over the world. He's just trying to increase the value of some property.
I mean, it makes perfect sense to me. Like, it's like, I wouldn't be surprised if someone actually tried that in the real world.
Just destroy all of California in order to make beachfront property. So at least there's that. But, like there's a reason why Lex Luthor is one of the favorite, you know, villains. And I would rather that she have been... That she have had a better plan, like a plan in general. There's this whole thing where, like, so she's set up in the beginning as I want to rule the world. And then she gets this thing that could literally hand her whatever she wants. And she doesn't really use it. And instead she gets distracted by a guy. Like, it's literally like driving around one day. I see a hot man. I must have hot man. It's not working. I'm upset. That's like 90% of the movie. And then it gets to the end and then suddenly she has like random takeover of Midvale. But I don't know. I felt like they almost treated her too much like a woman.
Well, yeah, that's the whole problem. Like, as you said, they should have just done a straightforward, like, this is Supergirl. We'll do like we did with Superman. And instead it's like, oh, well, you're a girl. And so you're going to fly around all dainty. That's like how you said that, you fly around all dainty. I did like the flying effects. I thought they looked good, but you're right.
Yeah.
She has a different feel to it and all that. And then the villain must be like But and honestly, if you wipe everything else away from this movie, the last mm-hmm. half of it is two women fighting over a guy. I'm like, really?
Yes.
This is what we did with Supergirl, the movie? And not even a guy like they know. Like, it's completely superficial. Like, he's like the handyman around the college campus.
He's like a groundskeeper or something. His name is Ethan.
Yeah.
And yeah, they like it's literally he's doing some yard work shirtless, and Selena sees him, decides he's hot and that she wants him, and then he like shows up to the abandoned amusement park where she lives for some reason.
Because of course she lives in an abandoned amusement park, right?
Naturally. Like, she lives underneath the roller coaster or something. At one point, Bianca comes, like, riding in on a little train.
Oh, it's so
car,
ridiculous.
Which is my favorite part in the whole thing. he shows up there, and then she just, like, uses her weird spells to make him fall in love with the first person he sees, which would never have backfired. Why would she ever think that? And, and then it just becomes the whole thing where the two women are fighting over a guy.
She's like a bad Disney villain, really. Like...
Yeah,
when you break it down.
I mean, she's basically like if Ursula had fewer songs.
Yeah, that's exactly what I was thinking. Ursula was the one because
they
Prince
fight
Eric,
over a guy
yeah,
too. But exactly. But even that is better. Like the climax of The Little Mermaid is at least stabbing Ursula with a boat, and the climax of this movie is like it's over.
Exactly. So the two plots, I guess, start to merge more than I thought they would because we find out that Nigel. Her boyfriend, who is a warlock, is also a math teacher at the school that Kara has gone to. I'm like, what? Why? Why was this plot line even necessary? I didn't understand. Like, were they just trying too desperately to connect these very random things. I don't even understand why Kara decided, like, oh, I better become a student in this school.
Yeah,
what's the logic
thing.
There?
I have two issues with the whole school-related plot. One of them is the fact that Nigel, whose whole deal is being angry with Selena because he introduced her to all these high society people and, like, is the reason why she has any kind of, you know, non-stupid life. Like, he talks about rescuing her from doing, like, hand palm readings or something at whatever. He's supposed to be all high society, but he is a teacher and there's no way he makes enough money to be fancy. Mm-hmm. So that's one problem. But also the fact that, like, Kara's on this very important mission to locate the Omega Hedron, and she decides to all of a sudden, no, I need to go to school. And I guess maybe if you're considering, like, it was the day after she slept outside, so maybe she just needed somewhere to sleep. But the fact that, yeah, she, like, encounters these students at this school and is like, yeah, I must go to school. I must now be a student.
Like, there's no... It kills
classes.
All sense of urgency, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's just a way for you to, like, introduce other supporting characters. Like, it was how they introduced Lucy Lane and Jimmy Olsen returning and, like, sort of connecting the movies. But that
didn't
was
get Christopher
just...
Reeve, we got Mark McClure.
Exactly. Perfect. Well, I think that works, actually. If you're going to, like, include things to connect the movies, I would rather it be something like Jimmy Olsen.
Well, I would argue that Jimmy Olsen should have been her love interest in this movie. And you don't
agreed.
Have Lucy Lane. You don't have
Lucy
Ethan. You don't have... Lucy Lane. By the way, yes, in all iterations of Superman, Lucy Lane is Lois Lane's younger sister, so that all checks out. And I think the actress actually looked like she could be related to Margot Kidder, so good job there. But in Superman the movie, she says she has a sister with, I believe it's like, three cats, two kids, and a mortgage or something. It's like, well, this is clearly not that sister... So I guess she has two sisters in this universe. So I don't know.
Or just retconning things.
Yeah, but then here's the deal. And I've always thought this was weird because there's so many interpretations of Supergirl. There's not really not one definitive Supergirl in the comic books that people can point to, right? But sometimes she's Kara Danvers. Sometimes she's Linda Lee Danvers. Sometimes she's Kara Kent. You know, there's so many versions.
Sometimes
but
she's the Matrix.
Yeah. Sometimes she's a shape shifting. See, this is where they got it from, Trisha. But in this one, she's like, yeah, I'm Supergirl. I'm Superman's cousin. And then she shows up and is like, I'm Linda Lee. I'm Clark Kent's cousin. I'm like, okay, what? That's no. You don't need to connect all those dots. That's very confusing and could make people figure out your secret identities if you're doing that. And she knows Clark Kent's name. All right.
Mm-hmm.
Why didn't she say I'm Kara Kent or something? She has to make first of all, there's a poster of Robert E. Lee in the school, which is questionable to begin with. So That's not still going to be around today. Tear that poster down. And so she has to invent a name based off that poster on the spot. And she should just come out with Kara Kent. I don't know. So
yeah, I don't know why she doesn't. I mean, I know that that's a whole comic book thing that she goes by Linda Lee or Linda Lee Danvers or whatever. But I don't know why she doesn't just use Kara, since it's a normal person name. It's not like Kal-El. I was very confused as to how the people of Argo City... I understand how they know about Earth, because they knew about Earth before. That's how, you know, Clark ends up here. But how they know not only that he made it, but that he grew up and became both Clark Kent and Superman.
And works for the Daily Planet.
And works for the Daily Planet. So, like, she just knows all this stuff because of, like, I don't know, space internet. And just stuff, just happens to know things. And I think maybe part of the reason why I have so much trouble with this movie is because I really like the Supergirl TV series. And I think that they introduced this idea of her wanting to become Supergirl so well that, like, I don't know why this movie had to start in Argo City and why it had to do all this stuff with, you know, everything that they did. Because in the TV show, they introduce her and the idea of Superman. And, like, Superman's not in it. He's not there. But she knows, like, she wants to live up to this idea, and she saves a plane, and then she becomes Supergirl, and there's a montage of finding her costume, and, like, 45 minutes, great introduction to Supergirl.
Yeah, they could have done it without Christopher Reeve, to an extent.
Yeah, they just didn't want to.
I just felt like because he dropped out, they had to scramble, and they clearly didn't have anything better to come up with, because you don't need, you're right, why can't she just be whatever she'd be doing in the comics? Why do we have to invent this entire weird, like, I'm a student, I'm this, I gotta go back here and there. She's Supergirl, she's on Earth now, let's continue. You know, she's part of Krypton. I really like all the, obviously, the Supergirl TV show now, even the way they did it in Smallville. You know, and they did it in Superman the Animated Series, they did it in Jeff Loeb's run on Batman Superman, when they kind of reintroduced the classic, if you will, Supergirl to the comic books, where she's, you know, in a pod, she's in suspended animation for whatever reason that is, either, like, stuck in space or in the Phantom Zone or whatever.
Right.
She's older than Superman. She came after him. They have a weird dynamic because she was older and now she's younger. That's an interesting angle to it. He has to kind of show her the ropes sometimes he doesn't, you know. But there's so many opportunities. There's so much there. And I understand this is 1984, so the character had only been around for, like, 30 years at this point instead of, like, you know, 70 like it is now. But even then, there was plenty of options. And that was the thing. It's like a 90s. It felt like Steel or something, where it's like, let's take all the stuff out that people like, and let's just keep the name and the general appearance of this character and go. And that's what this felt like. Steel. Like a complete misinterpretation. Yeah, Steel. We'll do a Superman special on that sometime.
Oh, God. just so many things. I feel like this felt very much like, let's capitalize on this idea of superhero movies and use Supergirl because it'll be something that we're used to. And it's actually surprising that they went that route, to be completely honest. Like, I'm surprised they didn't just go, okay, well, we'll make a Batman movie. You know, they didn't do that until 89. And I find that kind of fascinating that they decided to go with a female superhero, because these days, obviously, we don't do that. So, like, I have to give them a lot of credit for making that decision. To, like, actually take a chance and do a female superhero movie. Of course, then they killed female superhero movies for the next 20 years because this bombed so hard. But this was supposed to be a series of films.
Her first adventure, as the poster said, right?
Yeah, exactly. And because it bombed so hard, they never made any more. And I think that's why you introduced Jimmy Olsen as, you know, Lucy Lane's boyfriend instead of being Kara's love interest. And you get someone like Selina instead of a bigger, better supervillain. But also, Supergirl didn't have any of her own villains yet. And,
that's part of the problem. Even in the TV show, I'll say, I feel like, it's like, hey, what Superman villain do we have that she can fight this time? Yeah. Or at least a female version of. Oh, good. Here's Lena Luthor. Here's the female Brainiac. Here's Livewire.
There will be no bad talk about Lena in this room.
No, look, I love her. I loved her on Merlin. Kate McGrath is great.
Yes.
I just find it interesting that a criticism of the show was, it's like, oh, it's just like Superman or Smallville, just gender swapped. And they're like, oh, you know what? You're right. We didn't add a Lex Luthor. So they added a female Lex Luthor.
Yeah, and I think they make good, and, you know, we can have a Supergirl conversation, Supergirl TV show conversation at a different time. But, like, I think that they, at least in the TV show, they respect the character and they think about the decisions they make. I don't think the movie thinks about those decisions. Like, yeah, she's basically a gender swapped Superman, so they're giving her Superman villains, but ladies. Except Rain was an actual Supergirl villain.
Right. Davis Bloom from Smallville, right.
Yeah. I mean, basically, they did play it very much like the Davis Bloom arc,
right?
But they ended it better. And she
that much is certain. Yes.
but they do some really good stuff on the show, and I think a lot of that comes from the fact that they like and respect the character, and they're sinking an actual like thought and you know, creativity into it. Whereas in the movie, I think it was very much like, oh, let's just start cranking movies out. And I don't know what the budget was for this. I don't know what, you know, kind of changes they had to make once Christopher Reeve didn't want to do it or whatever, but it just feels very much like, oh, we're making a Supergirl movie. I don't know anything about Supergirl, so let's just do girl things.
Like magic. Girls like magic, right?
Girls like magic, right? Girls like witches. Fighting over boys. Girls like weird scenes with bumper cars.
Yeah, that was... So those NFL bumper cars made me laugh. But you mentioned the budget.
Yes.
$35 million budget at the time. Mm-hmm. And the gross at the time was $13,600,000. So it made about... I don't know.
About a third of its...
Yeah, about a third back, which is, you know... Ooh,
do you know offhand what the budget was for Superman the movie?
Let's check that out. Stand by,
guys. I wonder
guys.
How it compares.
So Superman the movie, which came out 6 years before.
Yep.
Yeah. Had a budget of... This is live, guys. This is live, unedited, always.
Live Googling.
Raw. $55 million. And it had a gross of $166,200,000. So
oh, it did really well. I mean, it's a good movie.
And
so.
Just, you know, and let's keep this up since I'm so let's do the initial. I think the best comparison to this honestly would be Superman 3 because it came out.
Yeah, because it was the closest.
So that had a budget of $39 million.
Okay.
And it had a gross of $60 million. So.
Okay. So I guess it was crazy. Pretty comparable.
Yeah, because they had no real even though it was critically not received very well. The Superman brand was still strong in the 80s. Mm-hmm. You know, it was Christopher Reeve, you know, and Richard Pryor wanted to be in it, right? That's how popular it was, right? So I don't think Superman 3 was bad. See, if you had a good Superman 4, it would have made up for Superman 3. It's like if you go mm-hmm. look at other franchises where you have a misstep, as long as the next film kind of gets you back on track, you're fine, right? But they just stopped. Like, after all the Superman 3 stuff, Christopher Reeve kind of lost interest, and the Salkinds were trying to do other things. Like, they did the Supergirl movie here. Mm-hmm. And then, later on, they did the Superboy TV show. So they tried to, work around Superman. That's the true forgotten.
They did so many things, and I knew about the Superboy show, and I forget about it until someone mentions it every time.
Yeah, I'll tell you this. I got through a couple of episodes of it. I guess one day I'll maybe try and watch, because, being a completist. But this movie... As ridiculous as anyone may think this movie is, it's way better than Superboy the show. All right, I'll just say that. But, speaking of budget, though, I did like how they tried to work around it because they made, an invisible monster come get Kara. I liked that. It reminded me, Forbidden. It kind of reminded me, Forbidden Planet, where it's, the big invisible monsters coming to get you, stepping on the car and this. Now, you do see it at the end, and it's, this giant demon thing, and obviously it's a big puppet, and it's like, well, at least it's something different. I wish it was more mobile. Like,
big
if they had
puppet.
A bigger budget...
Big Puppet was common at that point, though, because, that was the height of Henson, too.
Yeah.
And, I mean, no one's going to be the Labyrinth or even Legend with, giant Satan Tim Curry.
That was amazing practical effects, right? I want that guy to fight Superman, right?
Right? I want giant Satan Tim Curry versus Superman. But, I guess they were, they did a lot of cool practical stuff. I for all the things I hate about this movie... it is fun, but also the effects of the destruction, that scene with the invisible monster, you've got cars getting crushed and things getting, torn apart and bent, and it all looks, I don't know how, personally, I don't know how they did it because it looks very good.
It's practical, right?
Right, exactly. They found,
I love this era of the 70s and 80s, the practical special effects. We can, even in a cheesy, goofy movie like this, we can appreciate it more than stuff like today where it's like, oh, I wonder how many hours that took them to do in the computer when you see something
right,
nowadays,
well, like,
right?
the whole transition from inner space to outer space, you can sort of tell because our effects have gotten so good these days, but, back then, this was probably really cool, where they just sort of overlaid all the background stuff is, various, inks or some kind of colored liquid floating
in
other
liquid.
Yeah,
and it's like microscope stuff similar to what they did in Superman 1 and 2 in space, yeah.
Yeah, and I appreciate all of that. Like, it still looks terrible now because it's not 1984 anymore, and we can do cooler things with that. And, like, one of my favorite movies ever, The Fountain, literally did that as their way of, like, showing space. And now it's very cool because of, like, the high-definition cameras and everything that we're able to do, and I don't even know what they would have shot that kind of stuff on, you know, how they would have done
it. Well, they probably shot at 70mm was usually their approach because then you can, like, mat it behind something at 35 and doesn't lose it. Because when they don't, you see that really grainy. It's like a difference between Superman the movie flying and Superman 4 flying. They did not shoot it properly.
But like filmmaking technology in the 80s, like I have no frame of reference really for that. So I don't know like how you would have done like microscope kind of imagery,
right?
You know, in your movie in 1984. I'm spoiled by HD cameras.
And you see some of that stuff in the Phantom Zone too, you know, like the whirlwinds and whatnot. And I did like how they brought the Phantom Zone kind of in. It made it. I don't know how Selina got access to the Phantom Zone. That makes no sense.
The Omega Hedron.
Yeah. Okay. Film them right. Yeah. A wizard did it literally in this movie.
It explains everything.
So it was, and I guess Smallville was inspired by this. Because by the way, Jenno Swark, who directed this movie, he directed, I believe, 14 episodes of Smallville,
a bunch of them.
And including like some great episodes like Perry and Homecoming, Kent, some of my favorite episodes. And he also directed Jaws 2, so throw that out there, right? He fell on his sword and followed up Spielberg, one of the greatest ones of all time, Sigourney Weaver's work. But I feel like maybe his creative influence translated to Smallville, because this Phantom Zone in this is exactly what happens in Smallville, right? Because you get sucked into the iconic, you know, two-dimensional prism, right?
Yeah.
But
then you
kind
of get prism of mime.
Yeah. Well, as we're both, you can't see us, but we're both pushing up against the screen with our hands.
Literally Supergirl does mime for a few seconds.
And then she gets sucked into this wasteland, which is exactly what happens in Smallville. Because you think, like, what is the Phantom Zone in Superman the movie? Are they in this prism the whole time? But anyway, I liked that. I liked how they at least tried to articulate it in a physical way.
Yeah, the introduction of the Phantom Zone was very surprising. I did not expect that to be what happened.
Because there's no setup for it. Again, like you said,
exactly.
they expect
there's
you
no
to know
setup.
What this is.
There's no setup for it. Like, luckily, the Phantom Zone had been introduced as a concept in Superman 2. Mm-hmm. So, like, as long as you were a completionist and you were watching all the Superman movies, you knew what the hell was going on. But for, like, a good 15, 20 seconds, Kara's just doing mime. Don't know what's happening. There's just some force field reason she can't get through the thing. And then all of a sudden, she's floating through space. And you're like, oh, it's the Phantom Zone.
That's what that is. Because Zaltar did say at the beginning, he's like, well, I lost the Omega Hedron. I must go to the Phantom Zone. It's like, okay.
himself in timeout, only in a horrible wasteland where they put terrible criminals.
And of course, he finds her there and he rescues her. Does he die? Because you can't die in the Phantom Zone. How do you die in the Phantom Zone?
I don't know. He falls into the giant... You know, space sphincter.
Of death.
It's a very, like, you can also just sort of escape the Phantom Zone through this hole in the ceiling.
Yeah.
Like, did Zod and his friends leave that?
It must have been the crack from Superman 2 from the nuclear bomb.
It's still there, and they happen to be right there. It's the reintroduction of that character is so strange, where he's, first of all, I would like to change all of my ringtones to Peter O'Toole just saying squirt over and over again.
Squirt, squirt, squirt.
Like, what does that even mean? Is that alcohol? Are you very, very drunk? And then he's like sort of there and he's like, everything is terrible. I made a horse.
Yeah. I mean, I think and trying to think about what they were trying to say. I feel like they were showing like this guy's lost it. He's cracked. He's broken. He's done. But it was an odd play.
Yeah, it was very strange. It was like the Phantom Zone like makes you depressing and nihilistic and then you make horse pottery. And it was about like Kara sort of then helping her mentor to like be hopeful again, because that's the whole deal with the
super keep hoping for a better tomorrow. People.
Exactly. And then they go, and there was no reason for him to die.
Yeah.
And there was no fallout from him dying. Like, there wasn't a mourning period. She just shows up and is like, I'm awesome now.
But he turned into Obi-Wan, right? Because at the end, when she's fighting the monster, she's like, I can't. He's like, you can. Run, Luke, run.
Right,
okay,
exactly.
I guess that's what that was.
When she's fighting the monster in the weird stretching.
What is that special effect? They're like, all right, we want her to stretch. They're like, well, we don't have the special effects for that. What can we do? Well, we can stretch the image. We can not hold shift in Photoshop and move the picture around.
And they just like, because I believe that was like the early days of maybe some amount of digital effects. Mm-hmm. And so they were doing something funky with the image. And it was just like, but it was so obvious that that's what they were doing. It's very strange. I don't know why they decided to do that, but whatever. But yeah, it's a very strange thing, and there's no reason for him to die, and I don't know why they needed it to be that way. But I don't know. There's weird stuff. But I agree with you that Smallville probably took a lot of inspiration from that version of the Phantom Zone. Mm-hmm. Because the show did take a lot of inspiration from the Superman movies in general.
Right.
You know, it included all of the whole design of Krypton and the Fortress of Solitude and stuff is taken from that. And so why not take the Phantom Zone from Supergirl, a movie nobody saw?
Well, what they also took from Close Encounters of the Third Kind, where the mountain just shows up in Midvale, and she has the castle on the
all
top.
All of a sudden, there is a
mountain.
Where'd
that come from?
And then in the next time you see anybody, they're like protesting Selena's new rule of Midvale. It's like, wait,
what is going on? What is going on in this scene? I don't... She's taking over the town?
He owns the mountain, owns the town.
It did remind me, unfortunately, a lot of Superman 2, the Richard Lester stuff in the East Houston, Idaho. Which, but I live in Houston, Texas, right? And so this is not Houston. People, what they present in that film, they say it. It's Idaho. It's East Houston, Idaho. I know NASA's in Houston, and Zod says this is planted in Houston. It's very confusing. The odds of them hearing NASA transmissions from Houston then landing at a different Houston in the United States are very slim. But it happened. I guarantee, and I promise you all, Houston, Texas does not look like that.
Their Kryptonian GPS got ruined in the Phantom Zone, so they just ended up in the wrong Houston. They don't even really establish where Midvale is. Like, I know Midvale is supposed to be halfway between Smallville and Metropolis, which is why it's called Midvale, because Midway. They were very creative in the 40s.
Smallville. Midvale.
Metropolis.
Yeah.
But they don't really tell you where it is, because no one really establishes where Metropolis is.
It's the big apricot.
Right.
It's not New York.
It's basically supposed to be New York, but then so is Gotham, so they're next door to each other.
The way I see it, in my logic, I see Chicago is Metropolis, and
I agree.
And New York is Gotham City. That's the way I see it.
Yeah, I've always considered Metropolis to be more of a Chicago and Gotham.
And National City
is
LA and Supergirl the movie.
National. Like, there is an actual national city in California.
Oh, I did not know that.
I always saw National City could be Los Angeles, and Coast City is like San Francisco,
San Diego.
And or whatever. And
in the Green Lantern movie, you see San Diego Comic-Con built, San Diego Convention Center. You see it when Parallax comes to destroy it.
Wow.
So
sorry.
Talk about great superhero movies.
Coast City
there.
Is San Diego, I guess. Because the Green Lantern movie, which DC wants to forget, did say that. But for some reason, I always thought Central City was like St. Louis, which is literally smack dab in the middle of the U.S.
I think Central City is supposed to be Minnesota, like the Twin Cities. There's Keystone City, where J. Garrick Flash was, and then Barry Allen is in Central City.
Minnesota.
I don't know what the
choice.
Yeah. What's the other Twin City from Minnesota? Oh, Minneapolis. No. Minnesota's the state. Minneapolis is the city. What's the Twin City from Minneapolis?
St. Paul.
Okay, so yeah, St. Paul would be Keystone City, and Minneapolis would be Central City.
Okay, that's a new one. I like that one, actually.
That's your DC Comics geography lesson for the day.
You can now make a map.
And there's nothing, by the way, there's nothing under the Mason-Dixon line or whatever.
No, nothing at all. No, people don't live there. But yeah, they don't really establish like where Midvale is and like what kind of place. Apparently it's a place where teachers have pictures of Robert E. Lee on their walls. So maybe it's Southern. But yeah, it's just like this giant mountain appears and then all of a sudden she's in control of the town and like Ethan is her strange popcorn eating slave. And
yeah, so she somehow redoes the love potion and or gets more powerful and gets him after all.
Something like that. Yeah. I don't really know.
Although I did want to say, I love Helen Slater in this role. I think she was underserved in this movie.
Yeah, I agree.
And probably the cutest scene is when like her and Ethan are talking. And he's like, oh, can you do this? Can you do that? Can you? And he's like, can you bend still in your bare hands? She's like, yes. Like, she's just a little cute, like, yes, I'm strong. Like, I really like that little moment, a little acting choice.
I like that moment, too. I love that scene also because he's obsessed at that point because he doesn't know the difference between Linda and Supergirl. Mm-hmm. And he's in love with Linda, although this is after the love potion wears off. So he's still in love with Linda for reasons. And he's like, I have to go save Linda. She must be in trouble. And she's like, Linda can take care of herself.
Yeah.
Like, yes, she can. Tell him.
Now people give Clark Kent crap for, like, you just wear a pair of glasses and a suit.
All she does
is wear a wig.
Her disguise is brown hair.
I did, like, no one else saw that she was the same person except for that the lady who's in charge of the dorms, who's, like, drunk all the time, they said. And I thought that was funny. Like, she comes, she's like, what are you doing, Linda? Get out of that costume. I was like, this woman sees that she's the same person. I thought that was pretty clever. That was a
and
nice
doesn't
moment,
care.
Yeah, doesn't care. She's like, look, just get change out of that. That's cover up those legs, you know? So.
Yeah. Oh, something else we didn't touch on that I always get annoyed with when it comes to, like, female hero, any kind of female hero, because it happens in all kinds of stories, is that when she first arrives on Earth, she immediately encounters two disgusting, like, lascivious sexual assaulters, essentially.
I did want to ask you about this, because I thought this was a very, like, odd thing, because this is a kid's movie, all right?
Yeah.
And this, you know what, this stuff happens, and I'm like, I guess on some hand, I'm, like, glad they addressed it, and it was kind of an empowerment thing, where she's like, no, leave me alone. But at the same time, like, this feels really out of place in this little fantasy movie from the 80s we're watching right now.
But that always, it always happens, like, and it happens now too, that one of the ways that they establish that female characters are somehow powerful or strong is that someone tries to attack them and they punch them. And it's never like a mugging. It's never the scene in Superman where, you know, he catches the bullet in the alley. It's always someone is like, oh, you're pretty. We're going to go and do things you don't want to do. And then it's like, no, I'm going to punch you in the face. That happens way too often. It happens a lot in, you know, in any kind of story. It's happened in shows, you know, this past year, and it's tired and annoying, and we don't need that as a storyline. But of course, you know, that's what happens in this movie. That's the first thing she encounters on Earth. And I did enjoy that one of the guys was Max Headroom.
Yes, I saw. I love that guy. My favorite Max Headroom thing is he's in an episode of Star Trek The Next Generation called A Matter of Time. And he was originally, that role was for Robin Williams, but he had to drop out because he was making Hook, and they cast him. And I said, you know what? I'm glad they cast him. I think Robin Williams would have been kind of too big a star for Star Trek and a distraction, but I love him in that episode. I've loved him as an actor as well. So I'm
oh, yeah, me too. He's very good and very funny, but, like, that was such a weird decision. And
yeah,
it was a weird decision in terms of, like, I don't know why you needed to do that. It wasn't weird in terms of being surprised. I was definitely not surprised that that's the first thing that happens. It's always the first thing that happens.
Well, to that point, I mean, how do you feel that they represented women overall in this movie? I know it's the 80s, right? So it's 35 years ago. Well, how did you feel that they did in that respect overall?
I think they did fine. I mean, it's definitely a movie where, like, I mean, women are all at the front. So you have a female villain, a female sidekick to the villain, a female hero. Technically, I guess you could call Lucy Lane, like, her sidekick. But all those characters were strong and powerful in their own way. I think they went really cliched ways about showing you that. Like, you know, Supergirl is the one who solves all the problems, and she defeats the villain, and, you know, she gets the Omega Hedron back. But she's introduced as being sort of flighty and girly. She's definitely given, like, a more girly introduction to her powers. Like, she creates a flower and she floats around and she does weird flying ballet. She talks to a bunny. You know, so there's a lot of stuff where it's like, oh, you're doing the girl version. But like you said, it's the 80s, and I it's not like I expected more than that. The introduction of Lucy Lane was really interesting, because if you were making that movie today, that character is gay.
Yes, I see what you mean.
She was into Kara. Like, come on. Yeah. But that, at least that character is, like, you know, powerful and interesting, but at the same time, she has a line where it's like, don't make people think you're smart, they won't like you.
Yes, because Nigel has some crazy equation, and Kara's distracted, and then he's like, well, do you have the answer, blah, blah, blah? And she's like, oh, yeah, it's 5 billion, blah, 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 blah. He's like, how did you know that? And it's
right,
like,
girls
okay.
aren't supposed to have answers.
Right. Yeah, but yeah, you're right. She pulls her aside and tells her, like, hey, I'm going to fly under the radar. I mean, that was an odd statement. I guess it was to kind of... I understand what I'm saying in the context of the movie, because she's really not... She's not smart because she went to Krypton and all that stuff, and that was a really complicated equation. But it's if you take that, like, the greater message of that is, like, oh, that's what people have been telling women for decades. That's a very bad message to portray in a superhero movie about women.
And later in the film, Jimmy has a line where he tells Lucy, essentially, like, to shut up. And I don't remember what the line
is. Oh, he's like, now's not the time to be... when she's protesting. Right?
Yeah, exactly. Where she's protesting, and like that was a great moment. Like that the person leading the charge against Selena from like a civilian perspective is Lucy, and she's got signs, and you know, she's yelling about stuff, and then all of a sudden Jimmy is like, you know, now's not the time to be opinionated or something like that. Mm-hmm. And I was just like, why are you saying that? Why are you injuring my love of Jimmy Olsen by doing that? And that was a problem. I think overall, like, they obviously wanted to do a good female superhero movie. They failed, but they tried. But I do think it was tainted in many ways by, like, the attitudes toward women in the 80s.
Mm-hmm. Well, ultimately, I think what really fails this movie is there's a lack of a true story arc for Kara. Mm-hmm. She just kind of shows up and just kind of makes some weird decisions about, like you said, rolling in school for some reason, and, you know, getting involved in this love triangle that doesn't exist, and just kind of fluttering around. Like, you don't really have any moments for her like you had for, like, Christopher Reeve Superman, like, just moments of, like, self-discovery or whatever. Like, yes, you have this whole, I'm flying around, but there's no context for it, and then she's just Supergirl, and she's a static kid. She doesn't really learn any lessons that help her at the end or anything like that. She's exposed to some weird stuff about Earth she doesn't understand, but... And you know, there's always, like, Thor, right? There's some comedy for that kind of fish-out-of-water stuff. There are little moments there which are amusing. Like, she doesn't know what a bra is, I guess.
Yeah, I don't understand why she doesn't know what a bra is.
It's like, because in space, there's no underwear, right? So the rules were in Star Wars. Right?
I hate those rules in Star Wars. Those were sexist and stupid.
There you go. 1970s, 1980s mentality right there. But, I think that's a problem. There's no character... Because, obviously, in the Superman the movie, there's a giant character arc for Clark and Superman, but we got to spend more time with them and see him grow.
Yeah.
Supergirl, she shows up, she's there. I have no idea how much time passes. She seems to be in school enough. Like, they play lacrosse, they have showers, they go to Popeyes, product placement.
I forgot about, the Popeye scene is hilarious in the way that it's like Supergirl brought to you by Popeye's chicken. but the shower scene annoyed the crap out of me because the women don't do that.
I was going to ask, is this what it's like in women's locker rooms?
Women's locker rooms are not like that. When they first walk into the dorm and they're all like half naked and they scatter because there's a man, and like women also don't do that. Like, obviously there's less, you know, you're less protected around women, but like, you don't just get naked in the common room. That's not a thing that women do. Sorry, guys.
Clearly, movie was written by a man. So
clearly. Oh God, yeah. But that was annoying. It was very 80s in a lot of those ways where it's like that's.
And then I'd say the other thing outside of the story arc, and then just you remove all of the they didn't do this like the way that it's supposed to be in the comics. Just take all that out of it, right? I think lack of story arc for your main character, and then also just no stakes. Because when there's magic, right, you don't know what can Selena do, what can't she do, what can Kara fight, what can't she fight, what is she fighting? Oh, she's in the Phantom Zone. Oh, there's a monster. Oh, here comes the Ferris wheel or the giant construction car. Like, it's just so random that you can't really, you don't really know what the stakes are, so it's hard to get invested in them. So I have to say the two main things, those would be, the two main issues with the movie would be those.
Yeah, I definitely agree with you. I think I actually said at one point while watching the movie, there are no stakes. I don't care. She could, like all she needs is the Omega Hedron. Like, just find a way to sneak in and steal it. Leave Ethan, he's fine.
And then, you know, when she does get the thing at the Omega Hedron at the end, and she, like, tells Jimmy and Lucy, like, hey, guys, Linda had to go, but she's fine, but also I need you to do me a favor. And they're like, we understand. We never saw you. We never even heard of you. I'm like, what? Like, what? Like, she didn't even ask her not to. Maybe that's a deleted scene somewhere in a version I didn't see. But it's just odd to me. It's like, you think, hey, could you do me a favor? Don't tell anyone what happened here or whatever. And because it's magic, right? As soon as she gets it back and destroys Selena and her power, everything goes back to normal in a blink of an eye. So there's no evidence that ever happened.
Right.
But I guess they were trying to set up more sequels, but like keep it separate enough from Superman where they wouldn't have to acknowledge the fact this movie happened if they did make a Superman 4. I guess they were trying to do that. But to me, it just felt really odd and out of place. Like, hey, guys, don't tell anyone I was here, okay?
Yeah, I mean, it's the don't tell anyone I was here, but it's like, this is literally Jimmy Olsen and Lucy Lane, the two people who know your cousin. So, like, why wouldn't you be like, hey, let Superman know I was here. I'm going to go back now.
Clark, your cousin showed up the same time as Supergirl's cousin or Superman's cousin.
It's amazing. Hmm. I can't imagine how those two things could be related.
All right, guys, Zach here with an editor's note. Trish and I had so much fun talking about Supergirl. We got caught up in our conversation, and there were a couple things that I wanted to mention that I didn't get a chance to mention in our conversation, so I wanted to edit this in here. First of all, the musical score by Jerry Goldsmith. Now, Jerry Goldsmith, honestly, in my opinion, the number two guy after John Williams as far as music composers go. So if you can't get John Williams, get Jerry Goldsmith. Although, ironically, Jerry Goldsmith was Richard Donner's first choice to score Superman the movie instead of John Williams. Jerry Goldsmith had worked with Richard Donner on his previous film, The Omen, which Goldsmith had won an Academy Award for, the score. But due to scheduling conflicts and, you know, the Superman movie, you know, was notorious for going over budget and over schedule because they were filming one and two simultaneously. So Jerry Goldsmith had to back out. But John Williams stepped in to deliver one of the greatest scores in cinema history. So it's funny how that works. But anyway, Jerry Goldsmith did get a chance to dabble in the Superman mythos with this film. And, you know, it's a great opening theme, you know. And I think if you want to get a feel for the alternate universe of what, you know, Jerry Goldsmith's Superman the movie theme would be, and you can look at, obviously, Supergirl here. You can look at Superman the movie. Not Superman the movie, Star Trek the Motion Picture. See, both those movies have a genre : this is what you're watching now title. So yeah, Star Trek the Motion Picture, I think the Ilea love theme would be the Clark and Lois, you know, Superman and Lois love theme. Also, you know, some of the Krypton stuff might have been some of that the Voyager stuff for Star Trek, the interesting instrumentation, like all that kind of stuff. Anyway, those are just my thoughts on that. But I had to point this out because, you know, sitting here watching Supergirl, you hear the opening credits, and I'm like, this sounds just like Sequest, DSV. Now, if anyone remembers Sequest, it was a show on NBC in the 90s. It starred Roy Scheider from Jaws fame, and it was basically Star Trek Underwater. It lasted for three seasons, I believe. At some point, Schneider left and was replaced by Michael Ironside as the captain of the Sequest. But anyway, these themes are very, very, very similar. Now, John Debney did the theme for Sequest, and he'd actually written some Star Trek scores for Star Trek The Next Generation. So there is some Star Trek DNA crossover with Goldsmith and Debney. I don't know if anyone's ever pointed this out before, but to me, it was just so blatant. So I'm going to play you a couple clips back-to-back here. I just want to play you Supergirl theme. Sequest theme. All right, am I crazy? Did you guys hear that? Because I certainly did. But anyway, here it is for all posterity for us to compare and contrast the two. Finally, Trisha and I did not give scores, as we traditionally do. Letter grade score for our discussion here on Always Alone in Smallville. So we were messaging back and forth about it, and her response was C? I guess? It's such a weird movie. So I told her, I'm going to give it a D+. She said, well, I'm nicer than you. So as far as it comes to grading Supergirl, that is true. I am not as nice as Trisha. So she gave it a C. I gave it a D+. And if you think that's too harsh, I recommend you actually watch this film and come back to me. and then we can talk. But there you have it, guys. Back to our regularly scheduled or already recorded conversation. But I just want to get this little insert here before we start our final thoughts and wind down on the conversation. So I'll see you out there in inner space. So that was the acid trip that was Supergirl in the movie. It was interesting. It's an interesting artifact to the way superhero movies were done back in the day, especially for women superhero movies. Because I'll tell you this, I've never seen Elektra, and haven't. But Catwoman I saw on a plane once, and it's probably that or Jonah Hex are one of the two worst superhero movies I've ever seen. And it's just like, what were you thinking? Like, again, with a movie like Catwoman, they just completely threw out any kind of connection in the comics. At least with this one, they're like, all right, here's the deal. She comes from Argo City. She's wearing the costume. She's this, she's that. If you squint your eyes, you can see how this is Supergirl. With a movie like, you know, they learned nothing pretty much. I'm trying to say is they learned nothing in 20 years.
Yes.
When they finally got away from it. It took until 27. It took the DC universe, whatever we're calling it now, Worlds of DC or whatever. It took that to get a superhero movie starring a woman, right? And that's, to me, that's great. They're doing everything else wrong, but at least they got that right.
So. Exactly.
All right. Well, you know, the Blu-ray is available now from Warner Archive. I recommend, if you want to check out Supergirl, I do recommend that version. It's the most complete set. Like I said, it comes with the international version on Blu-ray and the director's cut on DVD. There are some behind-the-scenes features and trailer and stuff like that on there. So I do recommend it. Check it out online. But yeah, just, you know, thought it'd be fun. Just came out. Thought it'd be fun to talk about on a Superman special. Superman does appear in his poster. So yes. They just count as Superman appearing in this film. So that's how we get our Superman connection for a Superman special. But yeah, and then, you know, we're on a hiatus here between two episodes. So we'll be back next week talking about Legacy for Smallville. Back to our regularly scheduled Smallville. Christopher Reeve, unlike this movie, Christopher Reeve does appear in that episode of Smallville. But hey, Trisha, it's been great. I'm so glad we got to connect and be on the podcast here. And you'll be down the road later on the season talking about another episode of Smallville. But in the meantime, if people want to find you online, where can they find you and your work?
Well, you can find my work at Sci-Fi Fangirls. It's just sci-fi.com, and then click on the little Fangirls link. Or you can go to, I think we have sci-fifangirls.com. That's where I do all my writing. And then you can also find me on Twitter, where I do a lot of weird random stuff and mostly complain about comic book stuff, at Tricia Ennis. It's TRICIAENNIS on Twitter. It's very creative. That's me.
Excellent. Well, as for me personally, you can find me at MoronZach on Twitter. That's MoronZach. You can find me on my other podcast, Trek FM, at Trek FM on Twitter. I do Standard Orbit, the Star Trek original series podcast over there. You can find us on Twitter at Trek FM. I think I said that like three times now. And then you can find the podcast Always Alone in Smallville. You can find us on Twitter at AlwaysMallville1S. Find us on Facebook at AlwaysAloneInSmallville. And you can send us an email at AlwaysMallville@gmail.com. Once again, with one S. Well, that's going to do it for us this time, but until then, always hold on to Supergirl / Midvale / Smallville / Superman posters in your dorm room.
And we will see you in the inner space.
Yes!